Hi, Bill DeYoung here again with you. It's Arts Alive, the podcast of the St. Pete Catalyst. Currently on stage at Free Fall Theater is a magical, delightful romp of a farce. It's a comedy, folks. It's called Foreclosure, and we're going to talk about it today. Here with me today is the playwright Hannah Benitez and the lovely and talented Matthew McGee, who's been in, I think I just read, 62 Free Fall shows?
I think it's 23 now, but that's still a lot.
Well, it was a lot.
Yeah.
Good job.
Thank you.
So I saw Foreclosure on Sunday, and so it just knocked me out because it just it checked so many boxes and hit so many bells like a pinball machine.
It was a very sedate show, like the response to it. Like, if you can imagine, Bill, we were really spoiled on the Friday and Saturday because people roared on Saturday night, like screamed. On the Sunday matinee, I knew we were in a little bit of trouble when he ate the first cookie and there wasn't much of a noise. And I said, oh boy, I don't think they know they're pot cookies. You know what I mean? So it was a little tough that day, but
hey, I got it.
Really enjoyed themselves. So by the end of it, they were really thrilled.
It's a very, very funny show. And Hannah, there's so much to talk with you about. So I'd like to start with you. Your plays, as the world probably knows or doesn't know, include Dyke and St. Bridget, which is the sequel to Dyke.
Correct.
Is it the same characters kind of continuing the dialogue?
Yes, it's some of the same characters from the first play with a few new ones.
Oh, okay. Is that in production somewhere or in the pipeline somewhere?
It is in the pipeline. Actually, we just had a reading for the inaugural Pride Plays, which happened in New York City with Rattlestick Theater. It's a great LGBTQ plus theater festival for new plays that Michael Urey started. And so St. Bridget was a part of that this summer, and we had a great reading to a sold-out audience. We'll see where the play goes from there.
Your other shows, of course, are Adaptive Radiation. The one I watched several scenes from on YouTube today was Ash in Johannesburg, which I thought, well, that's interesting. How did somebody... I'm going to write about Arthur Ashe and this famous thing in the 70s that he did. And it looks fascinating. And of course, Gringolandia, when you and I talked, oh my God, you were doing Pippin at Freefall. That was 6 years ago. Gringolandia was about to, I think, debut somewhere.
Yeah, it was going to debut at Zoetic Stage, and then it got delayed for a few years because of the pandemic. So it actually ended up premiering in 2022. That sounds right.
Yeah, that's right.
Down in Miami with Zoetic Stage.
You're from Miami.
Yes, I am born and raised in Miami.
Okay, but you live in
I live in Brooklyn now.
So you're in that happening spot for the artistic nerve center of the universe,
yes,
as it were.
Some might say.
You started out as a performer.
Yeah.
Do you still act? Do you still go out and do that?
I do. I have been taking my foot off the gas a little bit with that. I've really been focusing on writing, especially for film and TV, because, you know, hey, listen, you got to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. I've sort of taken a little bit of a break with it, but, you know, when it feels right, I'll come back to the stage. We'll see.
Well, I wondered if... I'm going to see if I can articulate this so I don't sound like a total dope. If that's a conscious decision, I'm going to go in this direction, is it just gradual? Like, I get more out of this part of the creative process, writing.
Yeah, I think it's that. I also think that there is more possibility to actually attain a sustainable life in writing, as far as like making a living, that is just a more palpable of a possibility.
I don't know,
as a writer.
That strikes me as a little odd. I mean, I would think that, it's a big competitive world out there. There's a lot of people turning in scripts and getting rejected.
Sure, yeah. But if you can get through, if you can slide under the door, then you can actually, live a life.
Well, what was the process like for you? Was it just sort of, you wrote your first piece and said, wait a minute, this is really cool. I like this process of discovery. I get off on this more than like being on stage.
Well, you know, what's funny, I'd actually been writing plays the whole time. After I graduated college, I went straight into regional theater because, if I'm being honest, I had no place to live and I had no way to live because I couldn't have guarantors to get me an apartment or anything like that. And regional theaters, as we know, as Matt McGee here knows, house you.
Oh.
So I was just sort of like a tramp, traveling. And
never occurred to me, if you can get the work, why not?
Yeah, okay. Nice work if you can get it. I had been writing that entire time, writing plays, writing screenplays, but it took a few years for me to actually actually, I think, be taken seriously when I would say, like, hey, I'm actually a playwright. You know, why don't you read my scripts? I think a lot of artistic directors, free fall excluded, wouldn't take me seriously at all until I kind of got plucked from obscurity during the pandemic by my agent and manager, who are now with WME. So now I'm with William Morris, and they basically changed my life. They did, like, pluck me kind of from obscurity and completely changed the course of my life. So it was kind of a not a conventional path I took. I didn't go to any fancy schools. I didn't do any internships or programs or anything like that. It was a mixture of luck, being at the right place at the right time, and then being prepared when the moment came.
What's your process like in writing? I mean, I was thinking about this while I was walking up here today. How am I going to phrase this one? Is it sort of like... you know, you're in a house you've never been in. Let's see what's in this room. Is it a process of discovery, or do you sort of outline it out and it's just craftsmanship? Is it fun? That's the word.
It's always fun. Yeah. I derive great pleasure out of writing. It's not a slog for me. I don't suffer through it. I love doing it. I love waking up in the morning and doing it. My process is sort of all over the place. I wouldn't say I have one go-to process. I will say that since doing a few jobs in film and TV, I have sort of, I now rely on structure a lot of the time, but not all the time. So I often now will approach things from a structural point of view, but sometimes I wake up and I've dreamed out like an entire feature film, and then I like mumble it out loud and write it down, and it doesn't make any sense at first, but then as the day goes on, it starts to come back to me.
Oh, how cool is that?
You know, so I'm kind of all over the place, which is not really a helpful answer to writers who ask me that question, because I'm kind of all over the place. Sometimes I start with just a moment or an image or a historical event, and I work backwards. It kind of just depends.
Well, specifically with Dyke, which I watched some scenes from today, I mean, it has a message. I mean, it's family and it's sexuality and it's religion all sort of knotted together. So it seemed to me, since I haven't seen the whole show, that it had a point of view. It had something to say about those things. You know, whereas, did I read that Foreclosure is the first pretty much comedy you wrote? Like, I mean, there's humor in the other shows, obviously. I mean, obviously, but the Foreclosure, you know, it's as Matthew was saying, it's a laugh a minute, except for that Sunday crowd the other day.
They were pretty good. I hate to bash them, but it was a little, I was like, oh, okay, we're going to have to work a little harder.
I would describe them as an antique audience.
Yes.
Hey, I was in that audience. Yeah. Wait a minute.
You know, and sometimes whenever you see a show, you have to also think, as an actor, you can never worry too much about the laughs, because sometimes, you know, people are just smiling and taking it all in. Mm-hmm. A director told me that once. Sometimes they're just smiling audiences.
Well, back to my point, though. Let's hold on to that one, because if I forget where I'm going, the train goes off the tracks completely. Is this the first, like, I'm right?
Proper comedy.
Proper comedy. Yes. I didn't want to say straight comedy, because that just wouldn't have been too weird.
And that's just complicated with this play. It is the first, we'll call it a classically structural comedy that I have written. Yes.
CSC, it works.
There you go.
Okay. Why?
Why not, Bill?
And there's not many. There's not many these days.
There aren't.
You know?
Especially contemporary ones, meaning they are set today. There's very few. I'm not sure why. I think people don't know how to get around the cell phone issue, for one, just as a structural storytelling obstacle. And I think a lot of people just aren't very funny, if I'm being honest.
And they can't laugh as much as they used to. I mean, they do in this play, but I think that's a big part of it. I think comedy's a very tricky situation in these days, but I think it is getting better a little bit. That's changing a little.
Yeah, I think also a lot of writers are getting a lot of narrative right now that plays have to be, we want plays to be about certain themes. And I've had this literally said to me, we're only looking this year for this theme, this theme, and this theme. Yeah. And so then what happens is writers panic, and I can't blame the writers for this. Okay, I have to write my this play. Instead of thinking about, well, what do I actually want to write? And trusting that if it's good, the audience will like it.
Somebody said to me not so long ago, and they were talking about a company that wasn't Freefall, I won't say, you know, I've had it up to here with socially relevant plays.
Sure, a message plays.
I just want to be entertained. Now, there are a few maybe less than subtle social messages in this show, but it's really a door-slamming farce in a lot of ways. I wanted to just stop and say that, folks, if you haven't yet seen Foreclosure, which runs through May 11th, it's essentially the story of two women played by Renata
Eastlick.
Eastlick. Mm-hmm. I can't read my handwriting. Hi, Renata. We haven't met. And Sarah Delbito, who, of course, has been in several hundred. I think she was in several hundred with you. Free Fall shows, incredible talents. Yeah. And they are running a real estate office, an agency, if you will. They rent homes in a Gulfside town. I'm explaining Hannah's play to her while she's sitting here.
You're doing great.
Doing great.
There's a certain house that they're having trouble renting. For lots of reasons. And that's about as far as I'm going to go. There's a crooked politician involved. There is the incredibly talented Kelly Picard in the cast, whom you have seen recently, not only in Moriarty, but in its prequel, Baskerville. Yeah, Baskerville. Well, she's been in something else around here.
Yeah. No,
she's been in dozens.
She's been in a lot of free fall shows, and I think she was at American Stage in Tartuffe
a
few years ago.
Well, Kelly's doing, I don't want to say the same thing, but as she did in the Sherlock Holmes pieces, she plays multiple characters.
She does.
And she's absolutely amazing and very, very funny. The other member of the cast, of course, is Glenn Chiron, who is, I wasn't buying him as a rapper, I got to tell you.
Well, he is a rapper.
Is he?
Isn't he?
No,
turned cannabis baker?
Oh, she was just trying to really
embarrass
me.
You know what's so funny, though? When we started rehearsals, I actually thought, I said, oh, the rapper I really buy. But as we've gone on, Michael Davenport and Rick really have kind of grown a lot, you know?
Well, there's some, without spoiling too much, there's some physical elements to his costume as Rick that has had a tendency to sort of steal the show.
Yeah,
I say. And I don't want to spoil what it is, but...
Can you believe?
Really,
and I don't even know how Eric found that. I don't want to go into it.
But it's really something to behold. It's interesting you say that because Rizzy Boy has a special place in my heart.
Rizzy Boy. Word.
Whoop whoop.
Yeah. Whoop whoop.
Right. Well, don't tell Glenn I said. Actually, he's going to hear. Maybe he'll hear.
He's
going to
hear. He's a delight.
I will say though.
He was hysterically funny. I'm just thinking he was like several white rappers I've known in my life. He was kind of lame. I thought he was that.
But isn't that so Central Florida?
In a way.
I mean, I dated a guy like that in middle school.
Yeah. And who else is in it? Like, you've got Glenn.
You know, I forgot somebody, didn't
somebody,
I? Oh, my God. I want to introduce you to Camille Chevalier Milk.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, Leslie Jordan used to come through Savannah all the time when we lived there. And there was there's a lot of Leslie Jordan in him.
Very much.
There is a lot of Rip Taylor
from
the mustache. And this is Matthew's character, folks, and he is a psychic healer and a ghost finder. And how do you describe him?
Yeah, he's a clairvoyant, a psychic medium, a paranormal investigator. All based out of Pinellas County. That's
obviously
the joke of the show.
And he's a hoot.
He is.
He's absolutely a hoot.
Yeah.
Did I hear you wrote this with him in mind?
I sure did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how did that happen? You just thought, well, this guy's funny. I can style. I mean, did this character exist in an early draft as something else?
It never existed as something else, but I've always been obsessed with Walter Mercado, who some of you may know.
Yes.
He was a Latin American television, I guess we call him star, and he was sort of a spiritual counseling kind of prediction show where he'd do zodiac things.
It's almost very religious in ways too.
Very religious in ways. And he was just this amazing flamboyant Puerto Rican man. And he holds a special place in my heart. And so I tried to combine that with all of the references you made a moment ago into something to give only Matthew McGee to do.
Yes. You know what's so funny? So even when, you know, I'm one of those old school actors, I approach the character from the outside. I start talking about what they're going to look like even before Eric is even thinking about that. And very early on, we were thinking Walter Mercado, whose wardrobe is much more, a lot more capes, a lot more sequins, more stuff like that.
Capes and sequins,
And
I'm
then,
so there.
I know, me too. And then... Then I started thinking about Leslie Jordan a little bit, and then Dom DeLuise a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of hit me. I thought, oh, my God, you know, it's very easy to find a Rip Taylor wig because they just come from Amazon in a bag. And I thought, Rip Taylor. And we found some pictures of Rip Taylor in Hawaiian.
Perfect.
You know, he would wear these jackets, Hawaiian shirts, you know, these weird little slack outfits and tennis shoes. And I showed the pictures to both Hannah and Eric, and they were like, okay, yeah, this is our version of Camille Chevalier Milk. But he has a little bit of all those people we've discussed.
Eric Davis, of course, is the artistic director of Free Fall and the director of Foreclosure. You spend a lot of the second act in a rascal or a little, is that what you call it?
Originally, it was supposed to be like a little mobility scooter, but we found that it was they're kind of larger than what the doors were on the stage. So we ended up going with a motorized wheelchair, which has really, as you know, even on Sunday, has a mind of its own. Mm. Honestly, a scooter is almost easier for me to manipulate. I kept thinking, if I had a scooter, I could really make these turns. But that thing, if I push it the wrong way, it'll go. And I mean,
right through the set.
Yeah.
Did that happen Sunday?
Oh yeah, I got stuck on the
it was way over on the
seating bank, and then but even so, like one of the previews, I got stuck in the door. Like
that was one
of
the funniest moments of the show.
Of course, I mean,
the show wasn't hysterically.
No,
funny.
But you know what it is like for me though, as an actor, I don't get taken very seriously as an actor a lot because I mainly do comedy, and I think one of the things for me is if I stay in the moment. Even mistakes can feel like they're part of the show because I kind of can process them in a way that they don't come off as like eggy and like it's a big, the show stops, everything falls apart. I knew that all I had to do is back up and make some extraneous acting noises and pull myself out of there.
You pulled it out of the extraining acting noises
playbook. I love extraneous noise, absolutely, as an actor.
Those were most of the notes he got. The extraneous noise.
Yeah, come on.
Do you find, I mean, there are some racy bits in this show.
Sure.
I mean, that involved Mr. Davenport, was that his name? In the end? And again, no spoilers here, folks. But, I mean, this sort of staid matinee audience, you sort of go, oh, maybe they're, I mean, I saw people get up and walk out of hair. In the middle of the first act.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've not had, act, maybe.
And but, we've not had anything like that. And I mean,
that's
I don't,
what
I,
this is where I'm going.
I don't think that Hannah ever thought that would happen. But, you know, people like myself who've been in this area a long time, work at Freefall for a long time, I didn't know how they were going to take it. There was a reviewer, a blogger, a theater blogger came and wrote about it and said how great it was when he was in a very full audience, I think either opening night or maybe the Friday night preview. That was, he said there were Gen Xers there and there were octogenarians there and there were Gen Zers there and there were millennials and everybody was all laughing at the same stuff.
Yeah.
And he said, that's kind of like a win. And it really is. I thought too, that people might think some of it maybe is a little racier, but they do not at all. And in fact, I used to think, well, some of the older audiences know what a plot device
we weren't sure about.
Yeah, but they do, because let's face it.
I think I know what we're talking about.
We're not going to say what it is, but they all do it. And they laugh at that bigger than anything else.
They really do.
So it's kind of interesting. She's kind of found a contemporary farce with a variety of references. I mean, I make a reference. Some of the references are for everyone. Like I make references, and I'm not spoiling anything. I make a reference to like Norma Ray, the Sally Field picture. You know,
that was a great line.
It's a great line. But what I'm saying is, I make that, and like there are the old. I always said in rehearsal, I said the older audiences are going to laugh at this big every time. Yeah. So hold, because it's true. But then there are other things we reference, like Tokyo Driftin' and other things that are a little more now. But it gives everyone an opportunity to enjoy themselves. So honestly, we've really been impressed by opening weekend about how not only are the people staying and not like getting upset, they're buying tons of booze at the bar and they can't wait to see what happens.
That's a sign that it's doing well.
Of course.
You know, speaking of that, people are going, who the hell is Rip Taylor? What are they talking about?
I know.
I grew up on 70s television and I think you might have around in there somewhere. And I mean, I know Rip Taylor. You should do the confetti in the.
Well, you know, it's so funny.
Out of
he
a
talked
paper
about
bag.
That.
I did. When I was a kid,
oh, you had to rein him in.
Yes, come on. You know, when I was a kid, I loved Paul Lynn, Charles Nelson Reilly, Rip Taylor. I had no idea when I was younger why I loved them, but I gravitated towards those campy men.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, of course, I realize why that case is. You know, they're trailblazers, pioneers, these people. Now, Rip Taylor would tell you, to his death, he was not gay.
Mm. Did I ever tell you my Charles Nelson Reilly story?
Oh, no.
Wait till we get off the air.
Yeah, I can't wait.
I'll tell you that story.
A bonus on the Patreon.
He was very, very nice man.
Yeah, no, yeah. And, oh, God, he's the best.
Extremely intelligent.
Yeah, totally,
And, I mean, it was shtick is what he did.
But sure, he was very good at
really,
it.
Really, really smart. What happens next for you? Tell me about Rhonda.
Rhonda, yes. So the.
How about that for a segue?
I will say this. The title of my next play my next new play that is going to be programmed is going to be called Peg, PEG. Now, I won't tell you why because we get banned
Yeah, yeah, they'd shut us down
from all completely. Airwaves. We'd get asked to leave the state of Florida.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's what
run out on
that.
A rail, so to speak.
Yes, originally, the original title did have a pun based on a Florida politician that we all know.
No,
but I actually have changed the title because.
Oh well, I'm glad that I snuck in the back way yeah, here. Yeah, that's yeah, yeah.
No,
okay.
I did change the title, not out of any type of fear. In fact, I always think that you know there's no such thing as bad publicity, and if anything, that politician might illuminate the show into the spotlight.
Yeah,
but I did change it because it was just too long. And I think that
it
a
was
lot of
a long
it
title.
Was
a long
it was just I kind
but
of,
it rolled off the tongue.
It did
man.
Roll it really trippingly off the tongue. So yes, my next new play that will be premiering is called Peg, and it will be premiering at Island City Stage down in Wilton Manors, Florida.
Oh my God, it's going to be huge in Wilton Manors.
Oh, they're going to love it down in Wilton Manors.
And we had, oh yeah, look, what's
Wilton Manors?
What's Wilton Manors?
I believe it has the most gay men per square foot of any other city.
Oh, they're going to love
I'm
it.
Smiling for a photo right
yeah, we
now.
Are.
There you go.
It does, though. I mean, it's Fort Lauderdale.
It is basically Fort Lauderdale. And yeah, there's a great little theater down there called Island City Stage. And I think we're going to try and pursue it as a rolling world premiere, which means that two other theaters who are part of the National New Play Network will also agree to do the show sort of like one after the other.
I want to close with this. Was foreclosure a foregone conclusion? Look at that. I mean, was it already written? Or did Eric sort of say, can you write something for us? Or this is a world premiere.
Yeah, it's a world premiere, but it was not a commission. So it wasn't approached right. Like, hey, we have this idea. Would you write something like this? I just wrote the play one day in my apartment. And then I said, you know who should do this play? Matt McGee and Freefall.
Yeah.
And they said yes.
I forgot to mention, too, that we'd seen you. I don't know how many shows you did at Freefall. I saw Pippin and White Fang.
Five or six.
Yeah.
The first one I remember her in was Fiddler. Was that the first time you came to work with us?
Yeah,
it was Hoddle.
I was Hoddle in Fiddler. It was the first time I'd
one
ever.
Of the daughters.
Yeah. That was fun. That was a great show.
Yeah, so very good show.
You'd done like six of them. Were you in Peter and the Starcatchers?
I was not in Peter and the
Starcatcher.
I think
Kelly's in Peter and the
Starcatcher. Yeah,
Kelly was. Okay, yeah, this is all, I wasn't here yet.
Yeah.
This is all ancient
it's
history.
It's hard to believe how many years we've been around, and there's still people who don't know we're there. But, you know, we always talk about this. Sometimes theater just isn't, unfortunately, on people's radar as much as you would think. I mean, there have been people who say, I don't know where this theater is, and they've been there for 40 years. It just is the way it is. But every year, we grow. In not just, you know, not just the company, but just in people's
people, in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, more and more people are getting used to
becoming
and learning
part
about
of the zeitgeist.
Yes. Yeah,
you and really are.
And especially with shows like Foreclosure, because here's the thing. I've been thinking about this ever since we started work on the play. And this is a testament to how great she's written it, because it is constructed like a classic farce. There is political humor in it. But here's what's so funny. I've had ultra liberal friends come to see it and go, oh, it was so nice to laugh. And oh, that Michael Davenport, he's horrible. It reminds me of blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then I've had conservative friends go, aren't liberals hysterical? It kind of
goes over their heads.
It goes over their
what
heads.
What a ringing
a
endorsement.
You bring people in from different viewpoints or different backgrounds and they can all watch the same show and all laugh together.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a win, not just for us in terms of sales, but just, you know, for the human race to get everyone together laughing at the same type of stuff is pretty special.
Classic moment is when you make your entrance with the sunglasses on and the no spoilers, but it's very funny.
Yeah, no.
And you could tell that the audience was waiting for you.
Oh yeah.
Already.
Well, you know, it's so funny. It's 34 pages in and you have it written to where they talk about me for 34. I mean,
they
lots
really
of pages.
Do. Yeah.
The guy with the wig. Yeah.
The guy with the wig.
Yeah,
over and over again.
The guy with the Rip Taylor wig.
Yeah.
Hannah Benitez and Matthew McGee from Freefall Theater. It is such a pleasure.
Thank
to have you.
Likewise.
Here.
Thanks for having us.
Foreclosure is on stage at Freefall Theater until May the 11th, and you can go to freefalltheatre.com.
That's right.